begin our proceedings today, we have a motion, and I'll turn it over to Judge O'Malley.
Thank you. I hate this time of year. This is the second law clerk I've seen sworn in this week, which means they're leaving me. But I move the admission of Matthew Sipe, who's a member of the bar and is in good standing with the highest court of Virginia. I have knowledge of his credentials and am satisfied that he possesses the necessary qualifications. I am very familiar with his credentials. He has been a wonderful law clerk, and we have enjoyed having him and will be sad to see him go. He went to Yale Law School, which I forgive him for, and I tell him constantly it's because that undergraduate degree in economics and math from UVA grounds him enough so that it brings him down to earth and down to my level. But he clerked for Judge Mays in Tennessee before he on the district court before he came to clerk for me, and he's about to go become a Supreme Court fellow. At some point, he'll maybe get a real job that makes money, but in the meantime, he is progressing through the federal system quite well. So I am grateful for all of his talents and for the fact that he's so fun to have around. And with that, I move his admission.
I do not know this man, but Supreme Court fellow is good enough for me. Georgia Grant.
It's fine.
It's fine. I think it's fine.
I like the fun part. I've gotten to know Matthew a bit through his year, and on behalf of Judge Chad, we enthusiastically grant the motion.
Please stand and raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you comport yourself as counsel of this court, uprightly and according to law, and that you support the Constitution of the United States of America?
I do.
Welcome to the law of the United States Court of Appeals. That is so.
First case for argument this morning is 16-1275 Yang versus Boston Scientific Corporation. Just before you begin, Mr. Josepher, I'd just like to mention, because of the division of time, I see Mr. Wolf has saved time for his cross appeal, and candidly, the panel has questions about the cross appeal, not the merits of it, but whether or not, in fact, it is a cross appeal as opposed to just an alternative basis for affirmance. And therefore, we're not inclined to split the time up separately for the cross appeal. So we'll just consider the time to be 10:05, 15.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Mr. Josepher, whenever you're ready to begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The district court overturned the jury verdict based on ensnarement without ever actually determining ensnarement, which is to say, without determining whether the scope of equivalence actually ensnared the prior art. In doing so, the court committed three fundamental errors. First, in rejecting Dr. Zhang's proposed hypothetical claims. Second, in stopping the analysis there. And third, in failing to recognize that this issue had not been properly preserved in any event.
Are you saying that it was the court's job to come up with a hypothetical claim, even if yours were inadequate?
No. As you know, we think ours were adequate, but if they were not, if there was some difficulty, the court had several options available to it. It could have, after identifying a problem with hypothetical claim, it could have modified that hypothetical claim. It could have come up with its own. It could have requested, as one does say in Markman, submission of a new hypothetical claim to address an issue. It could have even at least considered the proposed hypothetical claim by BSC and modified it. We don't think BSC's proposed hypothetical claim was proper either.
It's your burden, however, to establish that the range of equivalence that you're seeking under the doctrine does not ensnare the prior art, right?
Ultimately, yes.
So, I mean, the first step of that journey is coming up with a hypothetical claim. I think that's your responsibility, isn't it, as the patentee, and not the district court's responsibility or the defendant's responsibility. It's up to you to imagine what your conception is of the range of equivalence that you are seeking under the doctrine. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm trying to understand logically why should anyone else have to pick up the bags here to sort things out?
Well, I don't know that anyone else had to pick up the baggage. One, I mean, in a moment I'd like to get to why we don't think there's any problem with the hypothetical claims, but assuming there was, which is your question, Markman's, I think, the best analogy, maybe the only analogy, where, I mean, it happens every day in this country, where a court rejects a plaintiff's proposed claim construction on a claim term. The court doesn't then refuse to construe the claim term and dismiss the suit. The court instead issues what it thinks is an appropriate claim construction, and the suit proceeds under it. A more draconian approach after a jury verdict makes little, if any, sense. And again, we weren't saying that the court had to just toss us out and start from scratch. Instead, could do what, say, this court did in Stream Feeder. Where in Stream Feeder, this court rejected the hypothetical claim that had been proposed by the plaintiff and accepted by the district court. This court then, after identifying the error in it, modified it accordingly and proceeded to rule on ensnarement. Again, RSL could have asked us to come back.
So do you have a hypothetical? I mean, I know you think your hypothetical claims were fine, but if they're not, do you have an alternative hypothetical claim that you think would avoid ensnarement?
I'm sure the hypothetical claims we put in, we could rephrase in ways that wouldn't seem to
like
matter
how?
To us, but would. Well, so for example, take hypothetical claim 3.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that, look, the hypothetical claims obviously are supposed to mirror the theory of equivalence at trial, right? The point is to test the theory of equivalence at trial against the prior art. So the theory of equivalence at trial was that even if the microelements in the express products were not connecting struts within the language of the claims, they nonetheless served the same function as a connecting strut because they connected the macroelements with a three-part connector to impart flexibility, which is the purpose, the function of the connecting struts. So the way the hypothetical claim 3 attempts to address that is by replacing a requirement of a specific geometry that's intended to grant flexibility, and instead just putting in what we view as a broader functional limitation of flexibility.
I guess if we're moving on to whether or not your hypothetical claim is a legitimate claim in the sense that it only broadens and doesn't do any form of narrowing, I guess what troubled me about the claim is that it talks about having a connecting strut column that provides increased flexibility compared to the first and second expansion columns. And so I understand the patent does talk about a connecting strut column providing some flexibility, you know, to the overall stent. But now the claim limitation is speaking in a comparative way that I didn't see anywhere in the patent. And now I'm wondering, what does that mean to be increasing the flexibility compared to the first and second expansion columns?
Well, understood.
Are you talking about longitudinal flexibility?
Yes. But it
doesn't say that in the claim, though.
Well, but the specification describes the relevant. In the specification, you're right, that it talks about in terms of longitudinal flexibility. But the point is just this, and this is why in an iterative Markman kind of way, I mean, if we need to rephrase it, we could have. If the idea is that the stent is comprised, obviously, for the BSC stents, you have the macro elements and the micro elements, which in our view correspond to the expansion columns, the connecting struts. The idea of the expansion columns is they provide the strength. So stent has to do two things. It has to work through the tortuous vessels in the body to get where it needs to be without causing other problems along the way. And then when it gets there and inflated, it needs to be strong enough to actually prop up and stay open to do its job. So the idea is the macro elements provide most of the strength. So when it opens up, the macro elements are strong, but they don't have the flexibility or the expansion struts. The idea is to have the geometry of these connecting struts that will be able to maneuver more flexibly through. So our attempt, which we think was fine, but I'm sure it could be phrased differently, to connote that was to say that it's the connecting struts that impart flexibility relative to what you would otherwise have.
I guess for me, to go back to the hypothetical claim, mm-hmm. Your hypothetical claim now excludes an embodiment in which, say, for example, the connecting strut column provides a flexibility that's equal to the amount of flexibility provided by the first and second expansion columns. Under the issued patent claim, where it just talked about an intermediate non-parallel section, there is nothing in that issued claim that precluded the possibility of the connecting strut column to have the same amount or even less flexibility than whatever the first and second expansion columns had. But now you've removed that from the hypothetical claim by requiring that the connecting strut column have an increased amount of flexibility compared to the first and second expansion
column. I guess there are 2 points there. One is the whole point of the invention, as described in the specification, is that the connecting strut imparts the flexibility.
To the overall stent, but it doesn't say anywhere that the importance of having a non-parallel intermediate section is to provide increased flexibility vis-a-vis in comparison to the first expansion column and the second expansion column.
It's true.
The first time you see that thought is in your hypothetical claim 3.
Well, I think it's not that thought. It's those words. And if those words were inartful, the point is just to explain, okay, what does it mean for the connecting strut to be providing flexibility? We're trying not to be
is taking all structural components out of your claim and saying all we need to do is claim the function of increasing flexibility, then that would cover virtually any kind of stent, right?
Which it would be our problem in the sense that if the claim's too broad, if the hypothetical claim is too broad, well, then that would prejudice us when we actually get to the ensnarement analysis. We don't think it is, but that's certainly not a basis for rejecting it. And the reason we don't is if you look at the hypothetical claim, it leaves most of the architecture in there. It only takes out the non-parallel intermediate section and replaces that with the flexibility, because that's what they said was not present. In other words, you have a three-part stent, right? The proximal end, an intermediate section, and a distal end. They agree that the proximate and distal ends are there. That's what they call the short straight connectors. So the dispute was over the middle. So all we took out of the literal claims is the middle. We did leave some architecture in, but if we didn't leave enough in, that would be our problem on remand at an ensnarement hearing. The other thing, though, is that the issue is not just narrowing in the abstract. In fact, to some extent, there's nothing wrong with narrowing. The point is to substitute the literal with an equivalence. And equivalents aren't always, entirely encompassed within. So, for example, if a screw is an equivalent of a nail, there's different. They're equivalent. One's not necessarily narrower. And in Dupuy,
are you saying you don't read stream feeder as requiring, when you come up with a hypothetical claim, to broaden the issued claim only? And that, in fact, under stream feeder, you're allowed to eat away at some of the issued claim scope?
Well, it depends.
In devising a hypothetical claim?
You have to broaden it for purposes of the equivalence theory that the jury heard at trial. In other words, the idea of stream feeder is, obviously you have to broaden the claim to encompass the accused product. That's your theory at trial. You can't then do some other unrelated narrowing to try to avoid the prior art. That's gaming the system. But take Dupuy's spine. There is a hypothetical claim. This court replaced a spherical shape with a conical one. And those don't fall within one another. But the point is that the conical was the equivalent at trial. Therefore, that's what you had to have in the hypothetical claim. Well, because if the narrowing...
What did your expert really say was the equivalent at trial? All your expert really said was, the magic words of it does the same thing in the same way with the same result. But it didn't explain how. Your expert didn't tell you. I mean, maybe that's the problem. If your expert had a real view of what the equivalence theory was, he might have been able to give you a better hypothetical claim.
No, the equivalence theory, and let me, sorry, I lost my ear. This is what I was looking for. The equivalence theory, I mean, to illustrate, for example, on the exhibit, it's page 41 of our brief, also found in appendix page 11, 649. Here, the red structures, these are the macro elements, and everyone agrees those are expansion columns. The micro element in the middle between the reds, the question is whether that's a connecting strut. And our expert's testimony is, you look at the green part, that, in our view, that's, even if you don't want to call it a connecting strut for the reasons that they give in their little infringement defense, it still has the same, it says has function way result. Why? Because the screen part is a three-part connector that connects one expansion strut to the next.
Can you give us the sites to the expert that you're reading?
The expert on the function way result?
Yeah.
That's, sorry. The expert discussed the function way result test. And this was Mike Lee. It would be a joint appendix. One site would be 8753 to 54.
8753
to 54. And then Dr. Kronos also followed up on it at appendix pages 9250 to 51.
But isn't Lee the main event compared to
Kronos? Yes, Lee's our main. Lee's our primary expert.
So it's 8753 to 54.
Did you say 887 or 87?
87. 87. 53. Here's a concern I have. You know we have this requirement under doctrine of equivalence that the patent owner needs to come forward with particularized testimony and linking argument on a limitation-by-limitation basis. Mm-hmm. You have a certain requirement for that to make sure that the jury doesn't get confused by a very conclusory doctrine of equivalence analysis. So if the no literal infringement verdict stands up, it stands up because the jury concluded that the microelements are expansion columns, not connecting strut columns. And so your theory, as I understood your brief, is there's nothing wrong with the microelement expansion column also being a connecting strut column as claimed. And that troubles me because, for purposes of doctrine of equivalence, and that troubles me because now you are having one structure in the accused product mapping onto two different structures in the claim. And the claim clearly calls for expansion columns to be coupled to connecting strut columns, and I don't understand how this microelement can couple to itself in the sense that it's, I don't know, some kind of Jekyll and Hyde role where it's both Jekyll and Hyde at the same time. It's a little schizophrenic to understand how this one feature of the express stent is actually both structures at the same time,
I think,
coupling to itself.
Yeah, no, I think that's their best literal infringement.
And so what? So getting to particularized testimony and linking argument. Sorry, this question is so long. Is that your expert didn't explain why, in the event that there's no literal infringement, this expansion column in the, i.e., the micro element, is also at the same time an expansion column coupled to a connecting strut column.
Right. Well, the point of the expert testimony is that you've got the macro elements expansion columns in the middle. You call it whatever you want. You can call it you can call it anything you want. The point is that what's there in the middle, the micro element, you know, whatever else you want to call it, it functions. It has the same, substantially the same function, way, and result as a connecting strut, because it couples the two things that are on the side of it in a way that adds flexibility. And he presented extensive then doctrine of equivalence testimony, including benchtop testing, finite element analysis. Right, he has his own document showing that what's in the middle there, whatever you want to call it for literal purposes, that imparts the added flexibility.
But it's fair to say that there's no expert testimony or testimony anywhere that says, okay, even if this micro element is deemed to be an expansion column, it is nevertheless also at the exact same time serving the connecting strut column for purposes of claim one. Even though you don't have to make any adjustment to it in order for the doctrine of equivalence analysis. For the doctrine of equivalence analysis, we're just saying it's also at the same time a connecting strut column.
Well, no, for equivalence purposes, the microelement is equivalent to the recited connecting strut column, right? That's why equivalence is different from literal. We're saying that the connecting strut is equivalent, the microelement in the accused product is equivalent to a connecting strut because it substantially is the same way results. I should probably save what little time I have left for rebuttal.
No, just continue answering the question.
How does it couple to itself under your doctrine of equivalence? How does the microelement... the microelement expansion column coupled to the microelement connecting strut column? I don't think right? The claim calls for a connecting strut column to to the expansion column.
Right, which is why I'm trying hard not to push back on literal infringement and just to talk about equivalence.
Yeah.
But for equivalence, I mean, the way the product works, you have macroelement, microelement, macroelement, microelement. So between two macroelements, you have a microelement. I'm not arguing right now that a microelement is a connecting strut. I'm saying that the microelement serves the same function as the connecting strut because it connects one macroelement to the next in a way that was proven in a variety of ways to impart the added flexibility. And so you can, in the middle, you can call the microelement another expansion column for literal purposes. I mean, I'm not trying to fuss over that right now. My point's just that the microelement is in between two macroelements and two expansion columns. And it joins them in the way that has the same function way result as the experts testified to and the jury agreed with. And that then becomes the predicate for hypothetical claim 3. But again, with hypothetical claim 3 or 5, if the point is that there's some words in there that look new or that seem different, then what the court could have done is either what this court did in Stream Feeder, modify the claim,
We modified the claim in Stream Feeder and UltraText both to explain why it snares the prior art. I mean, we didn't say we're saving the patentee here by modifying this claim. We're saying that the claim was that you could not do the claim the way it was done, and the only way you could actually have a fair claim would ensnare the prior art.
Well, that turned out to be the result in those cases, but I mean, the court, you know, quite properly, you know, did not just kick a jury verdict out because it didn't like the way a claim had been framed. It reframed it and then went ahead. Or, you know, as in Markman, we could have done something just more iterative in the district court.
The concern I'm having, and we're sort of full circle because this is exactly where we started this art discussion this morning, and the word you used repeatedly is could. I mean, I guess he could have done pretty much anything. So I don't think the inquiry involves whether he could have done it. The question is whether he was required or compelled to do it. And that, to me, is a little bit of a different analysis.
Right. But the question then is, if the first proposed hypothetical claim, the first proposed round of hypothetical claims, the district court sees a problem with them, the question is, does that forfeit the jury verdict then and there? And this court's never adopted any such a draconian result. No court or case ever has.
Can you explain the origin of the 11 hypothetical claims? I mean, how did you shove them all in at the same time? Was it an iterative process?
It was not iterative. They were all presented at the same time. And if it matters, it wasn't really. There's some double counting in the 11 figure. It was not really 11. But there were different claims that addressed different aspects. But it was all at once. They were presented at once, rejected simultaneously at once, in an order that simultaneously dismissed the case. There was no iterative back and forth like one would have in a Markman, which is really the only analogy. Instead, the court did something totally unprecedented, which was to overturn a jury verdict based solely on its view that the hypothetical claims were framed improperly.
Okay. We'll restore your rebuttal time.
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, if I may start where we came full circle, which is on this analogy to Markman, I would respectfully suggest to counsel that Markman is an inapt analogy for a very simple reason, that there is no burden of proof in a Markman proceeding. Each side bears equal burdens, and in fact, the court is obligated to come up with a construction if it believes it's important to infringement or validity issues down the line.
How would you interpret what the court did in Stream Feeder, though? In Stream Feeder, this court clearly didn't simply reject the patent owner's hypothetical claim and then reject the doctrine of equivalence conclusion. It went further and still did an analysis on a modified version of that hypothetical claim.
Your Honor,
is that what we're supposed to do now?
No, Your Honor, I that's why we're talking about burdens of proof here. I believe the court...
But then what did the court do in Stream Feeder?
It did what this court does from time to time in any number of contexts, which is to say Party A loses, and even if they were right, they'd lose for this additional reason. Even if we gave them the benefit of the doubt, even if we threw them a bone, they would still lose.
That would be an implicit reading of Stream Feeder, right? Because Stream Feeder doesn't say that even if language.
No, but I think that is what happened. I think that's the fairest reading. Because it certainly didn't say that the district court was obligated. It certainly didn't say that that this court was obligated. It just did it. It didn't explain why. And I think the fairest reading of why it did is to say it wouldn't matter. There was no saving this claim. It was just as we're comfortable in our initial decision, both as a procedural matter and as a matter of the merits. I think that's all that was happening there with Stream Feeder.
And this may put you in a difficult spot, but I mean, the DOE theory as it relates to just infringement makes a lot of sense, and I certainly understand why the jury found infringement under the doctrine of equivalence. based on the expert testimony that received, can you envision any hypothetical claim that would not read on the prior art?
Sitting here today, no. We presented what we thought was the most straightforward hypothetical claim, which was to scratch out the specific geometric limitations, and then said, does that read on the prior art? And the answer was, yes, it does. And we cited that, and that's in the appendix. And we also said, for that matter, it wouldn't cover our product. So it was 0-2 in that regard. But to answer how it went, counsel, I think, got it a little bit wrong as to how the iterative process worked, the 11 claims Your Honor asked about, and this kind of goes to your point, Your Honor, which is the district court ordered us to meet and confer, set up a process, and plaintiffs didn't want to participate in this process. And so they fought trying to involve themselves, but at the last minute, they threw 6 claims our way as part of a meet and confer, and we wrote back and said, no, those 6 claims don't work for one of 2 reasons. Either they're narrowing the claims or they're not changing the claim scope at all. Then they sent 5 more claims, hence the 11 claims. Now, the double counting, there was some dispute at the time whether 2 of the claims of the original 6 overlapped with the 5, so it's either 9 or 11. But in any event, then, as the transcript reflects, the judge walks into the courtroom and says, how are we going to handle 11 claims? And the plaintiff comes and says, well, Your Honor, we've reduced it to 2. And they argued hypothetical claim 3 and 5. So to say it was an iterative is not, I think, reflective of the record. It was iterative vis-a-vis us. We explained it's not like we surprised them at the hearing and said, here's the problem with the claims. We had extensive discussions with them, and that's where it went back and forth and back and forth, and then they decided to take 2 claims to the district court.
What's your response to the argument that you can narrow in ways that really don't relate to the debate that we're having over DOE, as long as you broaden in the more relevant circumstances? Yeah,
there are 2 responses, and one is kind of overarching a lot of what was said in the briefs, which is there's a fundamental misperception about how this process works in plaintiffs' briefs and argument, which is once you get to the hypothetical stage, equivalence doesn't matter anymore. Equivalence is irrelevant. The question is, here we have a claim. It's of this scope. We know it's not infringed. Now we need to expand it such that it infringes. We need to expand it just enough that it captures the accused product. As a literal matter, equivalence is irrelevant at this stage of the proceeding. So now that we've expanded it to cover the accused device just enough, now we're going to say, does that also read on the prior art? And if it does, well, then you're not entitled to that claim scope. So to your point, so that's kind of even today we're hearing a little bit of a misunderstanding of how the process works. But then to Your Honor's direct question, what the courts have said and Streamfeeder says, and I believe it was Ultratext as well, is we're not going to redo what happened in the patent office. And if you're nipping and tucking, expanding and trimming, we're not here to do patent prosecution for you. And so if you're narrowing in any way, shape, or form, that's not allowed. The only thing you're supposed to do is take that circle and expand it just enough so now it literally covers the accused device. That's the process, and that's not understood. Now, on hypothetical claim 3, I want to point out a couple things that may have gotten lost in the wash, which is that the district court took expert testimony, live expert testimony, subject to extensive cross-examination, and the district court found, and this is at, I think, A11, as a result of that testimony, found that the hypothetical claim 3 was broadening. So we hear attorney argument as to why it wasn't broadening, but this isn't a de novo question here. We have underlying discussions of fact by the experts that the court accepted. The second thing, and Your Honor, this goes to your point, there's a little bit of a shell game going on in what they did with hypothetical claim 3. Because the original claim called for the first connecting strut and then described its shape. So it said it has to be non-parallel. That was to the strut. But the hypothetical claim doesn't talk about the strut. It talks about the column. It now says the first connecting strut column is configured. So not only are they adding these limitations to narrow it, they're even changing what the limitation's talking about. They're no longer talking about the geometric configuration of the strut.
That's okay if the new limitation that they're adding, the functional limitation, encompasses that structural limitation that they removed. In other words, they converted a structural limitation to a broader functional limitation that encompasses the original structural recitation as well as virtually any other structure that achieves that exact function. That's really the question of whether, when you look at the what was deleted and what was added, do we end up with a larger claim scope because now we have a functional version of a previously structural limitation?
I take your point, Your Honor. I would just note that Wilson and DePue counseled us to expand the claims only enough to cover the accused device and not much more. Now, counsel is right that if you expand it too much, you'll actually help us at the end of the day. But I take your point. My fundamental point is the district court found, not just as a matter of grammar, not just as a matter of common sense, but as a matter of fact in light of expert testimony, that adding the limitation narrowed the claim in contravention of stream feeder. Briefly, Your Honor, on this, the alternative ground for affirmance and the failure to disclose doctrine of equivalence, I would ask simply on rebuttal for counsel to point us where in the expert reports you have a particularized function way result analysis of any kind. There is extensive discussion of function in the context of a literal infringement analysis in one of the reports, but it's not particularized. And more importantly, there's no way. There's no way discussion at all, and it's not tied to any claim limitation. It simply should not have been allowed to go forward from that point.
I guess the other side would say, and I'd like to hear your response.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that, well, the squiggly part of the micro element is serving as the intermediate section of the connecting strut.
So the function they identified is flexibility. Now, this is in the record, but it's not argued in the briefs. The reason that the microelements are more flexible is because they are small, not because they have that architecture. They are smaller and thinner. So it's a matter of the composition of the metal, not the geometric shape. Now, the reason that's not in the record at trial is because their experts couldn't say they operated in the right way, the same way. They knew that even under their equivalence theory, that the function of flexibility was not met in the same way. If they had to put that in a particularized limitation-by-limitation approach as called for in Aquatex, that would have been brought out in stark relief. Should I turn to the issue that was our cross-appeal at this point, unless the court has further questions?
That is a contingent cross-appeal, though, right? I mean, to the extent you call it a cross-appeal, yeah, so, but it's contingent because if in fact there's no infringement, then that cross-appeal doesn't even get resolved.
As a practical matter, you're probably right. Here, we struggle with this issue, too, Your Honor, as to whether it was an alternative ground for affirmance or a cross-appeal. Here's why we called it a cross-appeal, and I leave it to Your Honors if you think we fell on the wrong side of the line. If tomorrow they sued us on a different product prior to the patent's invalidation and said, well, okay, so Express isn't a contingent payment product, but this Stent B is, then in theory, the issue of the import of the patent office activities, et cetera, would be relevant to Stent B. Now, the odds of that happening are extreme.
But if we affirm the judgment otherwise, then that becomes an advisory opinion. And how do we do that without having the context of what the other product was?
You're probably right, Your Honor, but as you know, there's some division in this court about what's a cross appeal and what's an alternative ground for affirmance, and out of an abundance of caution, we labeled it as such. In theory, the relief requested in the cross appeal is broader than merely affirming the district court's judgment. Hence, under some characterizations of the test, it's a cross appeal. It's not an alternative ground for affirmance. As a practical matter, under the facts of this case, you're absolutely right. With that, unless the court has any further questions, I will give back some time.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Sorry, it's rebuttal, isn't it? Just a few.
How do you get around the fact that, as the trial court said, that on cross-examination, Mr. Lee admitted that the addition of the flexibility functional language would narrow the original claims of the patent?
No, because he didn't. I mean, what he testified to, what he eventually testified to was that if you put that language in there compared to nothing else, it's narrowing by definition. But he said if you put this in a replacement of the other, it's not narrow. So to go through, this occupies something like 10 pages of the trial transcript because they kept asking him the same question. But it starts around page 11137 where they keep saying...
Is this volume 3?
Sorry, it is. But the point of the questions repeatedly was Mr. Lee, just focus on this language that you're adding to replace the other language. Just that by itself, does that narrow it? And I mean, for a while he kept saying, "Well, there's no narrowing." But eventually, when they got him pinned down, and it goes over and over and over. If that's all he's focusing on, then sure, having that language in there compared to nothing is limiting. But as a replacement, it's not, is the important thing. And it ends around appendix page 11170, line 15, where he says, "Yeah, I don't think it's narrower. I think it's equivalent. It's clarifying." And that's why, in context, all he was saying was, "No, it's not narrower." But when he was asked these carefully crafted questions about, "Is it narrower compared to no other language?" Sure, it's narrower. Which brings me to one of the other points is, counsel was talking about whether a limitation was added here, and the answer is no. One was replaced with another. It's the whole point of equivalence or hypothetical claim analysis to replace a limitation with another. And if you can call that adding, but it's really replacing, and there's nothing wrong with that because that's what you necessarily have to do.
If it in any way narrows the scope of the original claim one, if original claim one is like a circle, and then yes, you've removed a limitation, so now maybe it's the circle gets a little bigger one way, but now you've eaten into it a little bit through the addition of your claim language, then is that a legitimate thing to do?
It's, as in stream feeder, it's illegitimate if the way you've eaten into it does not relate to the theory of equivalence, the doctrine of equivalence theory, the infringement, and instead it's just there to narrow the claim to try to evade the prior art. But again, it's if it's Dupuis. If the theory of equivalence is you don't need a cone, if you don't need a sphere because a cone is equivalent, well, the sphere is going to be both broader and narrower than a cone in some respects. But that's okay if the way that it's broadened for doctrine of equivalence is the same as the way that it's broadened for hypothetical claims. Because what you're looking to do is just to test the equivalence theory at trial against the prior art. And if there's any other immaterial narrowing that doesn't go to the equivalence theory at trial, the theory for infringement, it's not a problem, which is why, one, that is Dupuis, and two, that's also why stream feeder, said that what you can't do is broaden in one respect for infringement, but then narrow in a different respect to evade the prior art.
8753-54, I see Lee testifying about having performed some test that shows some flexing in the relevant area of the accused product's microelement, and then concludes, so it's doing the function of flexing. But that's only the function aspect of the function weighted result analysis. Mm-hmm. Is there something
there's more
that where he hones in on why it's substantially the same way? What he's pointing at and explaining why it's the same way, even though it's not a literal infringement?
Well, this is one of these cases where they're, the function way result, the way here, he continued to tie to the fact that, look, he thinks there's literal infringement, right? Because he thinks that what's between the microelements, between the macroelements, in his view, satisfies all the claim limitations. You've got the three-part connector, offset, peak-to-peak. It imparts flexibility in exactly the way that the specification of patents call for, the way, okay? His point, the point then for equivalence is just that if you don't want to call the microelement, if you don't want to call what's in the middle a connecting strut, call it anything you want. Call it spinach. It's still the same way because it has, you still have those three-part shapes that the connect peak-to-peak, offset-to-offset with the non-parallel intermediate section. It doesn't matter whether you want to call it a connecting strut, because you can also call it expansion column. That's fine for present purposes. The point's just that whatever you want to call the microelement, whatever you want to call the part in the middle, it's substantially the same way because the pieces are still the same.
But isn't the point of, as I read Dr. Lee's testimony, that what he said is you could have, you could envision a claim that would take away certain structural elements and therefore broaden what that middle column is. And in that way, you could literally infringe, or you could say that there's little infringement, but then you wouldn't have the function, which is the flexibility.
But it is true that the function and result have to, the function has to be flexibility with the result that you can go through the body. So if you did something else that would not serve the function.
What he said is that yes, when you add that functional element, that you are narrowing the claim in a certain way.
You know, in another abstract context, I can see where you could have a situation where that could be the case. But remember here, you know, under this specification, under the expert testimony of both parties' experts, the microelement adds flexibility. And the point of the connecting strut, the whole point of the connecting strut is to add flexibility. I mean, before the invention, which goes back to the mid-90s, it was understood that the problem was you had these stents that were either too rigid or too flexible. They were too flexible, but then they weren't strong enough when they got where they were going, so they collapsed. Or they were too rigid and they just couldn't get where you were going. And if you opened up the body to get the stent there and it didn't get there, the patient tended to die on the table.
Right. So that's
the point of this.
I mean, I thought that was the point that he said, that structurally you can envision a connecting strut that would claim to a connecting strut that would make the accused product literally infringe that claim, but it would not provide the flexibility that is necessary to not read on the prior art.
Hopefully I'm not just getting hung up on language, but if it's the connecting strut that's described in the the literal connecting strut in the claims and spec, the whole point of the literal connecting strut is that because of its geometry, it does add flexibility. That's what it's there to do.
Right, but there's nothing in the patent that teaches or suggests that whatever flexibility it provides, it necessarily is an increased amount of flexibility over the flexibility provided by the first and second expansion columns.
Well, but the idea of this, the whole, I don't know, sometimes the most obvious things aren't the ones that are said in technical documents, but the whole point of the expansion columns, right, is that they provide the strength. They have to be bigger and stronger to provide
the
strength.
But not all of them in the prior art did provide flexibility.
This is the question I most wanted to get back to on the bundle, actually. It was your question about if you got your hypothetical claim, how could you possibly win in Stearman anyway, which I think is really important. Because the district court didn't reach it, we haven't really discussed it in the briefing. But to understand where we were back at that point in time, and this is in the Mr. Lee testified to all this in the Stearman hearing, the thing they mostly rely on is Ouija. Ouija is not prior art. Dr. Zhang swore behind it and presented considerable evidence it was not enabled. The other two references that they rely on, and I recognize these are disputed facts, but that's the point. The district court should have resolved the experiment disputed facts. The other two references involved single-piece connectors that did not impart flexibility, as opposed to the three-part flexible ones with this design. In fact, Brown uses a connector for stability and actually teaches away from using it for flexibility, which is the exact opposite of what Dr. Zhang invented. And the reason that this being a groundbreaking invention is part of what helps explain why BSC paid $50 million down, and then, you know, with additional payments due later, which is what we're here to talk about today. All we're asking for, though, is a chance to actually have our actual Stearman case heard.
Thank you. We've got both sides.